It's not just the floods that are grabbing headlines in Pakistan. The nation is in an uproar. This time, it's not over ineffectual politicians. This scandal involves the national cricket team. Earlier this week, three members of the Pakistani team, currently playing a series of matches in England, were accused of accepting money from a man who was attempting to defraud bookmakers. NPR's Philip Reeves joins us from our London bureau. And Phil, what more do you know about the accusations?
Well, this is basically about a phenomenon called spot betting. That's gambling, not on the game's outcome, but on certain incidents that can happen during a game, sometimes very small incidents. For example, you can bet on how many runs, or want of a better word, points, will be scored during a certain period of play. Now, in this case, a British tabloid newspaper, the News of the World, handed over a huge amount of money, the equivalent of $230,000, to a middleman. This was during a recent big game between Pakistan and England. And in return, the middleman told the newspaper exactly when during the game there would be what's called a no ball. That's when the bowler, or in baseball, the pitcher, steps out of his zone, rendering the delivery illegal. Now, sure enough, the no balls happened exactly on schedule. The deal was all captured on video by the newspaper. The paper published its story. Uproar followed. It's alleged that two Pakistani players, both of them bowlers, and also the captain, were implicated in this.
So they didn't throw the game. They were just doing small actions that were resulting in big payoffs. You mentioned $230,000. That's big money.
You know, it's not throwing the game, but it really is affecting the game. But, you know, spot betting on cricket's become really big business in the last few years, particularly in South Asia. There are believed to be enormous betting syndicates in operation there. It's illegal, but it's very hard to stop.
What are the consequences to these three members of the Pakistani team?
Well, the police in London have been interviewing them. They've been provisionally suspended by cricket's governing body. If they're eventually found guilty, and it'll probably be weeks before we find out, they could be banned from cricket for life.
The Pakistani ambassador in London met the players and said afterwards he did not think that they're guilty. Is that how the Pakistanis are viewing this? I mean, do they think their cricketers have somehow been set up?
Well, the envoy to London did indeed suggest that they were actually set up. He said that quite categorically. It looks to me like those remarks were more of an attempt to sort of play to an angered public back in Pakistan and to show that the Pakistanis, that, you know, the government's willing to fight for these players. I think in Pakistan there is great frustration and indignation over this. It's been a very tough time for the Pakistanis. They can't play international cricket at home because last March the Sri Lankan team, which was visiting their country, was attacked in the city of Lahore, and so that brought an end to international sport there. And they've been mired in all sorts of scandals and controversies in the last year or so. So they're having a tough time, and it's a huge sport in that country. People love it there.
You talk about a public that's angry. The Pakistani court has summoned seven players and the chief of the cricket board to face charges of treason. I mean, what does that say about the depth of feeling about the sport in Pakistan?
Well, it is a sport which is almost a sort of parallel religion. It's a country which is going through a really terrible phase at the moment. We all know about that, the rise of Islamist militancy, the regular bombings there, the corruption of their own government, and so on and so forth. It's a very unstable place. Cricket has always been a huge love amongst the Pakistanis. At the moment, I think it's a particularly needed form of entertainment and of escapism, and I think people find it very difficult to accept that even that is being spoilt by events.
NPR's Philip Reeves in London. Phil, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen, and joining us is Puzzle Master Will Shortz. Hey, Will.
Hi, Leanne.
So is your life today more puzzles than ping pong, or vice versa?
Oh, it might be veering toward ping pong. I've just bought 50% of a building in my hometown to open a table tennis club, We're going to have about 11,000 square feet of playing space, which is enough for 18 tables. I think it'll be the largest table tennis club in the Northeast. We hope to be open by November.
Wow. You wouldn't do anything unless it had an est at the end. You know, the best. You had a challenge that had absolutely nothing to do with table tennis last week. Would you repeat it, please?
Yes, I said take the word bookman, B-O-O-K-M-A-N, change one letter in it, and rearrange the result to name a famous person who wrote books. Who is it?
Who is it?
Answer is Nabokov, as in Vladimir Nabokov.
Author of the book Lolita and more. We received more than 1,000 entries this week. Our randomly chosen winner is Kevin Callahan from Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Leanne.
How long did it take you to solve the puzzle?
That one came pretty fast.
Good for you. What do you do in Eugene?
I'm a math teacher at Madison Middle School.
You must be very, very busy this time of year.
I am. Yes, I am.
All right. Well, Kevin, meet Will. Will, meet Kevin. Let's play.
All right, Kevin. I'm going to give you a five-letter word and a seven-letter word. Rearrange the letters of one of these words to get a synonym of the other. For example, if I said alloy, A-L-L-O-Y, and devoted, you would say loyal. Because loyal is an anagram of alloy, and it's a synonym of devoted.
Okay.
All right, number one is thing, T-H-I-N-G, and evening. And here's a hint to get you off. Rearrange the letters of thing to get a synonym
night.
For night, right.
Yeah.
And the anagram can be either word. That's for you to figure
out.
Okay.
That's what I was afraid of. Is that going to be either one?
Number two is state. S-T-A-T-E, and cleared, C-L-E-A-R-E-D.
Declared?
Declare, good. March, M-A-R-C-H, delight.
Delight?
Uh-huh.
Charm.
Charm, good job. Timer, T-I-M-E-R, and deserve.
How you doing there?
I'm still working.
Okay.
Which word did you anagram, Leanne?
Timer.
That's correct.
I still don't
you
have
want, it. You want to go for it, Leanne?
Sure. Merit.
Merit, is it?
Merit, yes.
It's those,
thanks, Leanne.
It's the definitions, because they can have more than one, and that's
yeah.
Where confabulate everything.
That's right. Try this. Irate, I-R-A-T-E, and grenade, G-R-E-N-A-D-E. This is interesting. There's actually two answers here, but you only need to give one.
I think I got one.
Yeah? Which word did you anagram?
Grenade.
Grenade.
That's right, meaning irate.
I'm not getting it.
Enraged.
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 Also, enraged. Also angered works, either way.
Oh. That would have been easier.
Try this one. Nadir, N-A-D-I-R, and deplete. D-E-P-L-E-T-E.
Will gave me a hint when doing anagrams, if you actually put the words in like bowling pin formation. So the first word is the one pin, and then two, then three. It helps your head get out of the linear way of
linear
thinking.
Linear mode, yeah.
All right, Leanne, jump in. What's your answer?
Drain and deplete.
Drain is
drain.
Right, drain.
Awesome.
All right, try this. Onset, O-N-S-E-T, and boulder, B-O-U-L-D-E-R.
Stone.
Yeah.
Stone, that was fast. Awful, A-W-F-U-L, and in-house, I-N-H-O-U-S-E.
It's usually used to describe a villain sometimes.
Oh, I'm blinking.
All right, Leanne, go ahead.
Heinous.
Heinous, is it?
Oh, good one.
All right, here's your next one. Girth, G-I-R-T-H.
Okay.
And correct, C-O-R-R-E-C-T.
Right.
Yeah.
That is right. And here's your last one. Agree, A-G-R-E-E.
Okay.
And itching, I-T-C-H-I-N-G. As in, you are itching to do something. You are...
I'm blinking on this.
I'm blinking on it, too. Let's see.
How about if I tell you it starts with an...
Eager.
How about if I, Eager. You're eager to do it.
Oh, Kevin, your eager response.
Oh, wow, that's harder when you're doing it live like this.
And that's why we give you something to remember this experience by. We have someone to tell you what you'll get for playing today's puzzle. He's an award-winning musician and frontman for one of Las Vegas's finest creations. Here's Brandon Flowers of The Killers.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin, the Scrabble Deluxe Edition from Parker Brothers, the book series Will Shorts Presents Ken Ken, Volumes 1, 2, and 3 from St. Martin's Press, one of Will Shorts' Puzzle Master decks and riddles and challenges from Chronicle Books, and a CD compilation of NPR Sunday Puzzles.
What do you think, Kevin?
That was very cool.
It is cool, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And if you can be by your radio next weekend, you'll hear my interview with Brandon Flowers about his new solo album.
All right.
Flamingo. Yeah, something to look forward to. And before we let you go, Kevin, what member station do you listen to?
I listen to him and I'm a member of KLCC.
KLCC.
Yes.
And Kevin Callahan in Eugene, Oregon, good luck this school year with your middle school math students, and thanks for playing the puzzle.
Thanks, Leanne. Thanks, Will.
All right. Thanks. Will, what are we going to gift our listeners with in terms of a puzzle for next week?
Well, this week's challenge comes from listener Eric Iverson of Eagan, Minnesota. And it's a simple question. What is the longest common word in which all the letters rhyme with E? I have my answer. We'll compare notes next week. So again, what is the longest common word in which all the letters rhyme with E?
Okay. You can't have like 15 letters. And I know anti-disestablishmentarianism doesn't work, so... We'll leave it to the listeners. When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, and click on the Submit Your Answer link. Only one entry per person, please. Our deadline is next Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Please include a phone number where we can reach you at about that time, because we're going to call you if you're the winner, and you'll get to play Puzzle on the Air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and Weekend Editions, Puzzle Master Will Shorts. Thanks a lot, Will.
Thanks, Leanne.
The 5th century BC playwright Aeschylus was famous throughout the ancient world. His plays were celebrated, and he was a well-known celebrity. But when he died, he asked that his epitaph make no mention of those plays, but rather his military service. Here's what the inscription on his tombstone said.
This memorial covers Aeschylus, son of Euphorion, an Athenian, though he died at wheat-bearing Gela. Of his glorious prowess the sacred land of Marathon can tell.
Aeschylus was a veteran of the legendary battle at Marathon. It happened exactly 2,500 years ago, and it pitted a heavily numbered band of mostly Athenians against the far mightier Persian army. It also lent its name to the famous race, which we'll hear about in a moment. Historian Richard Billows writes about the battle in a new book called Marathon, and he says that that one day in 490 BC actually changed the course of Western civilization.
What we can tell from the way the Persians treated other cities, Greek cities that they attacked in this same period, is that if the Athenians had lost the battle, the city of Athens would have been destroyed. The Athenian citizen population rounded up, put on ships, and transported to Persia to be interviewed by the Persian king, Darius, at that time, and then probably resettled somewhere near the Persian Gulf, where they would have been lost to history. And as a result, all those great Athenians of the 5th and 4th centuries, the likes of Thucydides and Socrates and Plato, one could go on, simply would never either have been born, or their works would never have been written and would not have been able, therefore, to shape subsequent classical Greek civilization and Western culture as we know it.
I mean, you say that had the Persians defeated the Athenians at Marathon, democracy would never have flourished.
The first democracy that we know of in world history was created by the Athenians just 15 years before the Battle of Marathon. It was established as a result of a kind of coup d'etat against a tyrant who had been ruling Athens. And that democracy was a very young and new experiment when the Athenians faced the Persians.
Now, tension had been building up between the Persians and the Athenians for about 20 years before the Persians actually invaded and landed at the plain of Marathon. When they did arrive in 490 BC, the Persians had about 25,000 soldiers. Is that about right?
That's what historians estimate. The problem is that our ancient Greek sources grossly exaggerated the numbers of enemy forces, both to make themselves look particularly good if they won, and, of course, to excuse themselves if they lost.
So how were the Athenians, a much smaller contingent, with obviously help from the Plataeans, how were they able to hold off the Persians for several days before the battle even began?
Well, they established themselves in the foothills that overlook the plain of Marathon below them. And it was in a position where if the Persians had tried to attack them, they would have had to advance uphill against a force established in a defended position.
The Athenians literally had the higher ground.
Exactly.
How long do you think that battle lasted?
The battle itself, probably not as long as 2 hours.
Was it a miraculous victory, or were the Athenians basically better fighters?
It was seen as a rather miraculous victory in the sense that beginning about 550, when the Persian conqueror Cyrus began the creation of the Persian Empire, the Persians had for two generations fought throughout Western Asia and the Eastern Mediterranean region, conquering empire after empire and people after people and never suffering any serious reverse. So they were seen as this invincible juggernaut that really couldn't be stopped. And yet this one tiny city-state, the Athenians, dared to put its army of about 10,000 men up against these Persians. I think themselves probably not really thinking that they could win, but determined at least not to go down without a fight.
Now, of course, there's the legend of Philippides, who ran all the way from Marathon to Athens to announce the Persian defeat. That's a length of about 25 or 26 miles, which is how modern marathons are measured. But that story, as you've come to believe, is much more complicated.
Yes. When the Athenians learned of the arrival of the Persian force, they sent this runner, Philippides, to run from Athens to Sparta, a distance of about 140 miles over several significant mountain ranges. Philippides was what was called an all-day runner, very highly trained athlete, and he ran from Athens to Sparta in 2 days, delivered the message asking for Spartan help, and then receiving the Spartans' reply that they could not march for another 6 or 7 days, he ran all the way back to Athens, another 140 miles. So he actually ran 280 miles, not 26.
Almost like an Ironman triathlete rather than a marathon.
Exactly. Now, after the battle, the Athenians, even though they had won the battle, could still lose the war because their city, their families, and so on could be captured. Mm. So they had to march, in the words of the historian Herodotus, literally, as fast as their feet could carry them, from Marathon to Athens. So here's the thing. It was actually the entire Athenian army which went as fast as they could go from Marathon to Athens.
The entire Athenian army basically ran a marathon.
One suspects that they didn't run the whole way.
Right.
It was really a speed march.
I'm curious. You emphasize the importance of democracy in the Athenian victory. Why?
The way that the Greeks fought was very egalitarian. Every individual soldier fought at his own expense. He paid for his own equipment and for his own upkeep. And essentially voluntarily, they were participating members of the social and political community. They felt that this community, because of the democratic system, was theirs. They governed themselves very directly. We tend to make a distinction between the government and the people. There was no such distinction in Athenian democracy because the people were the government. It was that sense of this is ours, this community, this political state that we've created is our thing. So the Greek victories over the Persians were intimately tied up with the political system of participatory democracy that the Greeks had created.
That's historian Richard Billows. His new book called Marathon is now out just in time to mark 2,500 years since that epic battle. Richard Billows, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the chance to speak.
Earlier this summer, a group of scientists spent 2 weeks in Indonesia atop the only glacier between the Himalayas and the Andes. They were taking samples of ice cores to find out the effects of climate change on that glacier. Lonnie Thompson, a professor of earth sciences at Ohio State, led the team, and what he witnessed there shocked him. While they were there, the glacier was literally melting under their tents. It receded about 12 inches. The group is now back in the U.S. They're studying the ice cores for clues about past weather patterns and the future of how climate change may affect that part of Asia. Lonnie Thompson joins me from the campus of Ohio State now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Guy.
So I gather you never expected to witness, I guess, so dramatically the melting of the glacier. Can you describe what it was like up there?
We've conducted 57 expeditions around the world, and this is the first one where we actually experience rain on the glacier every day. And rain is probably the most effective way that you can move energy from the atmosphere to the ice surface and consequently cause the ice to melt. So it's the first place where you could actually see over a very short period of time the surface actually lowering around you. My tent, when it was taken down, was actually there was a plateau of ice that it was setting on because the tent protected the ice underneath from the rain.
And I've seen some photos of your campsite, which our listeners can actually see at our website, npr.org. Tell me a bit about this glacier. It's the only one between the Himalayas and the Andes. It's a tropical glacier in Indonesia. How important is this glacier for researchers?
Well, it's located about 4 degrees south of the equator. It's the only glacier that is on the western side of the Pacific Warm Pool, the warmest waters on Earth. And so for looking at the history of things like El Nino, it's a wonderful location. Unfortunately, that glacier is going to disappear in the next few years.
Are you getting a sense, based on your samples, of when this glacier will disappear entirely?
If you look at that 12 inches or 30 centimeters that was lost over that two-week period, if that is anything that's representative of the annual ice loss on these glaciers, you're looking at losing over 7 meters of ice in a year. So you could lose those glaciers in as little as 5 years.
What about the environmental impact of the glacier's loss?
They're very small. If you look at the total ice coverage on the mountain today, it's about 1.7 square kilometers of ice. Since the turn of the century, the glaciers on Papua have lost about 91% of their area. You know, part of our mission was a salvage, collect the record before it disappears so we have a history from that part of the world. And we also store part of those cores in our cold rooms here at Ohio State because we know that 20 years from now, there'll be new technologies, better understanding of the climate system, but there's not going to be any ice to drill.
This is what you study. I mean, I guess you kind of expected it, but did it in any way alarm you?
Well, I think it does, in as much as that often when we look at what's happening to ice on the planet, we look at the area of ice and we use satellites because these areas are so difficult to get into. The problem with the satellite or aerial photography is you don't see the vertical thinning that's taking place. And consequently, there'll come a year in the future that there'll appear to be a glacier based on the area of ice, but it will disappear the next year because of the thinning from the top down. And to me, that's very sobering.
That's Lonnie Thompson. He's a professor of earth sciences at Ohio State. Earlier this summer, he led a team of researchers to the top of one of the last tropical glaciers in the world to study the effects of climate change. He joined me from member station WOSU in Columbus. Lonnie Thompson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
I am proud of the recovery actions we have taken. I believe they have made the difference between a second Great Depression and a slow but genuine recovery.
That's Christina Romer, the outgoing chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, speaking earlier this week at the National Press Club. James Fallows, national correspondent with The Atlantic, joins me now, as he does most Saturdays. Hi, Jim. Laboring as usual on this Labor Day weekend?
Yes, but this is the light-lifting part of the weekend. So nice to talk to you.
Jim, Christina Romer's last day as the president's top economic advisor was yesterday, and it was just as the national unemployment rate rose to 9.6%.
Indeed, and I thought this valedictory speech she gave the National Press Club this week was actually very interesting, and the theory I have derived from it is that we have to keep in mind three sort of strands of economic narrative going on right now, which have both political and economic ramifications. One is what's happened to the real economy, and she did lay out in that speech how profound the shock had been in just the collapse of worldwide demand, which of course supports jobs around the world. She pointed out that in 2008, just before the Obama administration came to office, the loss of wealth from the stock market and the housing collapse was about $13 trillion.
Wow.
And, you know, to put that in perspective, the entire U.S. output per year is in the $14 to $15 trillion range. So it's a huge decrease, and the world and the U.S. have not recovered from that. So that's strand one. Strand two, from my point of view, is the political economics of this issue. There was a debate inside the administration and the Democratic Party of how large a stimulus to push for and how hard to push over Republican opposition or whether to try to gain some bipartisan support. And you had the Republican decision fairly early on basically to oppose it. There were zero Republican votes in the House and only three in the Senate for the stimulus program. Then finally, you have the strand of the economic story to tell. Now, 2 years after the presidential election, the Republicans can say whenever there's the unemployment rate goes up, see, we tried what the Democrats did and it didn't work. And the Democrats are forced to say, well, it could have been worse or we're making slow progress, as opposed to saying, as Christina Romer is reported to have done internally, look, we tried to do more, but they wouldn't let us, sort of the Harry Truman argument. So I think all those things are in play in the midst of still continuing real economic problems.
And then, of course, early next week, Jim, the president is expected to announce this series of measures to boost the economy. A lot of speculation that that will include a whole new round of tax cuts. Do you think the White House is acknowledging that the stimulus plan may not have been enough?
Well, I think they're just the objective fact that the unemployment rate is once again rising, although slightly and lower than it was a year ago, and various other indicators of the recovery stalling out in different ways. The political aspect of this that is difficult is that the administration knows that Republicans just aren't going to support this in the time that's left until the midterm elections. And also, it's very difficult to see how any of these measures could have much effect before the midterm elections. So that's the political problem, and the underlying economic one is figuring out what is the right kind of stimulus to give an economy at this point to try to offset the continuing lost demand.
And I suppose it's not necessarily in the interest of Republicans to back that, given that almost every poll shows that they will gain seats in November, quite possibly retaking control of the House. And we've been hearing it all summer long, but the real campaigning begins, of course, now, early next week.
Sure. It's one of the truisms of American politics that Labor Day is the time when most of the public just begins to pay attention to politics. I think we all need to be careful about having any idea of what's going to happen 2 months from now on Election Day. The fact that almost nobody in Alaska predicted that Lisa Murkowski was going to lose in her own Republican primary, that's one of a million illustrations of experts always being surprised by elections. But it is clear, on the one hand, that a lot of the fundamental forces certainly seem to be favoring the Republicans now: economic distress, some of the Democrats being confused on the message, the usual fall off that happens in a midterm elections, and the fact that the Democrats took a lot of close elections 2 years ago and 4 years ago. So there's a lot of marginal seats that are naturally Republican seats which are in play.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, as always, thank you and happy Labor Day.
Thanks. Same to you, Guy.